Cue Harry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Oh, good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to 297th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 296 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. Once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. I hope you'll join next week and every week at the same time. Before getting into tonight's conversation, some announcements. First, my latest book, The Trump File, a short collection of poems dating back to 2009 and a short story, all revealing my feeling for the present occupant of the White House, is now available on Amazon, both in print and in Kindle formats. Additionally, I am in the middle of editing the Hudson Valley Anthology of 2009, a collection of the writings of slightly over 60 of today's writers. I am shooting for its release in mid to late November, just in time for the Christmas holidays. And now, some local Hudson Valley news. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 23rd year, usually at 6:30 p.m. in the Mahopac Library on 6th in Mahopac. More than 175 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also has a morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So November's meeting will be on Wednesday, November 20th, at 10 a.m. at the Hill Boulevard Diner, which is, surprisingly, on Hill Boulevard, just west of Route 6 in Jefferson Valley. There are also two poetry workshops in the area, open to both fledgling and experienced poets, one in Mahopac and one in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of the month at the Mahopac Library at 6:30 p.m., and the Yorktown one on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hart Library in Sherbrooke, New York, at 6 p.m. In November, The Mahopac one will be held on Wednesday, November 13th, while the Yorktown one will meet this coming Wednesday, October 23rd. If you're confused by these groups and dates, email me at johnmack13@gmail.com. Finally, this October open mic session of the Hudson Valley Writers Center was held the last Friday, and the theme was The Wicked Word about Halloween. The next one is on Friday, November 15th at the scenic Philipsy Manor train station overlooking the Hudson in Sleepy Hollow, New York. There will be a featured artist followed by an open mic session. The theme of the open mic will be 1 year before the election, but readers are not bound by the theme. A complete guide to all of the center's many offerings may be found at writercenter.org. That's WRITERSCENTER, one word, .org. Anyone, once again, wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. Next week, October 27th, my guest will be attorney Michael Grace. Mike is an old basketball buddy who served as three-term supervisor of the town of Yorktown, New York, and is now the candidate for the Westchester County legislator. Now, to tonight's show, once again, to 97 in the series, my guest is an old friend, documentary producer, agricultural economist, and consultant to foreign countries, Charles Chip Mann. Chip has just released DVDs of his multimedia history of the early days of personal computing power sharing. I first met Charles, and I will keep calling him probably to the use of his old nickname, which is no longer relevant, I'm told, over 30 years ago when I was the president of the Big Apple User Group, an organization of Apple II users, developers, analysts, and writers. This was in the pre-Macintosh and IBM PC days when the first spreadsheet VisiCalc was just drawing business professionals in the world to the world previously occupied only by teenage gamers. Even then, Chip had a strong interest in sharing and service. We'll explore all of these elements of his background on tonight's show. Charles was supposed to be my guest on September 29th, but problems in my studio at the network interfered. I am delighted that he could join us tonight. The listeners wishing to join Chip and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Good evening, Chip, or Charles, and welcome to the show.
Hello, John. It's very nice to be with you. It's been many years since we've spoken. Much water over the dam.
Yes, and let's start right at the beginning. But where'd you grow up and go to early school?
Well, I grew up in a small town southwest of Buffalo called Derby, New York. Through sixth grade, I went to school there at the local elementary school, grades 1 through 8, with 4 classrooms and 4 teachers. And then at seventh grade, I had the opportunity to go into Buffalo, where my father worked, so I could drive in with him each day, to a country day school, as it's called, that category of school, private school, non-boarding school called the Nichols School, which is still going strong there, which gave me a really solid grounding for my later work in college.
Do you remember?
So that's where it all started.
Do you remember what your interests and earliest aspirations were as a young person?
Well, it was an agricultural area, and I grew up fascinated by farm equipment, tractors, and so on. And I, at a young age, got the opportunity to drive a tractor, first of all, picking up hay bales, which didn't require too many driving skills. So at 9 years old, I had my first job driving a tractor, picking up hay bales. And I stayed doing this tractor driving until I was about 16, till close to when I graduated from high school.
Were you early
that
in?
That was very formative.
Were you an early
I came
reader,
to have
or
a
were you
great
early?
Interest in, no, I wasn't an early reader. I was a late reader, and I had a terrible time with multiplication tables, spelling, and to some extent reading. They didn't diagnose people for these issues back then, but I suspect that I certainly had some short-term memory issues. And my grandmother took me over on that and drilled me incessantly on the multiplication tables and spelling till I finally could do it.
That's interesting. I have about then and now, I have an extremely close friend who has a book out about his experience delivering beer to people in Vietnam, and he was always extremely glib and obviously bright, and he didn't do well in school. He got thrown out of a Catholic high school. He got a GED in the Marine Corps. He wound up many years later with a master's from Harvard without a college degree, but he only found out when he was 73 that he was dyslexic. And I'm sure there were many people with learning disabilities that we just didn't understand enough then, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
What did you do after grammar school?
Well, as I mentioned, I went to high school at this Nichols School in Buffalo that started in seventh grade.
Okay.
And that put me in a good track to go to college. The school system that I was in Derby had a good regional high school, but they didn't send a whole lot of kids to college. I mean, there were not a whole lot of kids that were trying to go to college. I mean, it wasn't that the school's preparation was inadequate, but in any event, and along the way, my father was somewhat of a self-taught engineer, and I had always been intrigued by mechanical things, so I pretty much settled that I wanted to be an engineer. So that's where
then
I was
where'd
in
you go
high
to,
school.
Then where'd you go to college then?
So I went from there to Cornell, where several family members, an uncle of mine particularly, had gone to engineering school. And at Cornell, I decided that I hadn't given enough thought to this engineering profession, that maybe I wasn't as well suited to that as I had imagined. And I decided that I really wanted to have a much broader range of studies in the liberal arts, and just lots of things beside the rather tightly constricted set of courses that we were to take as engineers. So I actually transferred to Williams College, and that's I graduated with a BA in American History and Literature from Williams College. So I kind of veered away from the engineering, but as you'll see as we go on, the math and particularly math background that I'd gotten in the engineer track and at Cornell stood me in good stead somewhat later in my life, as you'll see when the story progresses.
Yeah, and what had you planned to do with your liberal arts background?
Well, I just always expected to go to work for some business. The business being unidentified, but that was just the track I was on. And in those days, this would have been, I graduated in 1956. Companies came to college, I mean, they still do, I'm sure, but we were in more of a slump where the birth rate had slumped in the Depression in my peer group. So it was quite a strong recruiting demand for graduates. And I just signed up for several companies and was really attracted to Alcoa, which had a very good sales engineering program. and the fact that I'd once been an engineer was at least of some usefulness there. I also was the business manager of the newspaper, which gave me some added visibility, let's say. And I went to work for Alcoa right out of Williams College, and a wonderful 6-month training program through all their, not all, but many of their factories and rolling mills and fabrication facilities and so on. It was really a very excellent program, and I was very content with it.
That's another change from then and now. I was an English major, and I was very lucky by the luck of the draw to get into information technology and to spend my career doing that. But in those days, you went to school to get an education, and then you figured it out toward the end. Now, it's even to expect grammar school children to have some idea of what they want to do and chart their educational path, definitely during high school. How long were you with Alcoa?
I went through this training program, and then toward the end of it, after I'd been with them for a little less than a year, my draft number came up, or was coming up. As you recall, we still had a draft then, and all of us recent graduates, if that didn't go to graduate school, and I had no interest in graduate school at that point, faced the necessity to do some sort of military service. So I, with a friend of mine in this training program, who was a Colgate grad, faced the same issue. So we went together to the Coast Guard. We were happened to be working in the Alcoa plant across the river from New York in Englewood, New Jersey. And we went down to the Coast Guard OCS recruiting post office downtown in Wall Street area, and we were going to sign up for Coast Guard OCS. And my friend Jim went through the preliminaries and was accepted into the next step of testing and so on. But they saw my glasses, and they asked me what I could read on the eye chart without the glasses, which was 3 or 4 lines down. And, I couldn't go beyond 3 or 4 lines down, which wasn't enough. And he said, you're not going to get in the Coast Guard. But he said, I happen to know the Navy recruiters, and they're below their quota for the month. And when they go below quota, they give waivers for people that wear glasses. So he said, I think if you go down to the Navy, that you can probably sign up there. So I went into the Navy OCS and spent 3.5 years in the Navy, and I was on a leave from Alcoa, military leave.
And where did you see service in the Navy?
I was went into a program that was called Pre-Selected Air Intelligence. If you scored well on these tests, somehow the fact that intelligence was in the title put you in this category where they would pre-designate you to be an air intelligence officer, which is basically the briefing officer in an aircraft squadron that stands up and talks about the radio frequencies and the weather and this is where your mission is, et cetera. And that's what I was trained to do after I got my commission and left Newport OCS. And then from there I went to an aircraft squadron in Norfolk, Virginia, after I had the training, air intelligence training, and served with the squadron for a year, including a North Atlantic tour on the aircraft carrier Intrepid is what we were assigned to, which is now, as you well know, in New York, at the pier there in New York as a major aerospace museum.
All right.
So that's the ship I served on. And then for the last 2 years of my time in the Navy, I spent at a school teaching other people coming through the system to be air intelligence officers. And during that time, John, I met an extraordinary range of people, extraordinary particularly in the range of things that they were planning to do after they got out of the Navy. And I began to think that I had not given anywhere near enough thought to what I was going to do. There were, I would say, easily less than half that were planning to go into some sort of business, but others were going to be journalists, or there was one person who was, I became quite close to, who was a geographer and was going into map making and things. And I thought, I just haven't given this enough thought. But I did, in fact, go back to Alcoa, but it was kind of a burr under the saddle at that point. So I went back to Alcoa, but I was continuing to think about doing other things. And I
and then
had
what
some
did you
overseas
do?
Experience by then.
What did you do after
the
you...
Turning point. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. What was the turning point, and then what did you do?
Yeah, two points. One, I worked for a very interesting part of the company. My boss, a gentleman named Cliff Sands, had Alcoa was just beginning to develop a major program to try to enter the packaging business in a big way, particularly beer cans, soda cans, that kind of thing. And the issue was how to get a way to open the can with aluminum. The church key was not a suitable way to open it. And so eventually they came up with this pop top, and one of my experiences there was to share with my boss one of the first successful applications of this pop top. It took them much experimentation before they got that to work. And as you remember, the first ones you tore off completely, and they were a major menace on beaches and so on. And then eventually they figured out how to set it up so that the tab you pulled stayed with the can and didn't go separately littering up places. So, and of course the aluminum was valuable enough to make it a really feasible, recyclable product. And the potential that they saw was to sell more aluminum for cans than they were selling for airplanes. So, I mean, that's how large it was and is now. I mean, it's enormous. Anyway, so that made for a very interesting time at Alcoa. But the turning point was I had, when I got out of the Navy, I'd spent some time in Europe with taking my unused leave money, and had done a little bit of studying of French. And a contingent from Benin, where their Alcoa had major aluminum interests, there's big mines there, came to Pittsburgh. And I got a call from a friend of mine who was in the international division, who had also gone to Williams College. But he was Swiss and, of course, a fluent French speaker. And he said, I know you've been studying French. He said, would you come out with me in this group of visitors tonight for dinner, because I have to entertain these people and I can't find anybody else that speaks French that can come with me because they don't speak any English. So I went out with them and had a really amazingly satisfactory evening, and I thought, this is really interesting. I could really imagine making a career in international business. That's how it got started. And then that, again, was another sort of burr under the saddle. And I, about a year later, I decided to actually, I tried to see whether I could get into Alcoa International, but they said no. For an American citizen, you'd be 20 years from now before we'd consider you to do that, because we just, you know, all the lower positions are filled with nationals, and as many positions as we can, we fill with non-Americans. So that didn't seem too promising. So a couple of years after I was back out of the Navy for a couple of years, I went back to school in international business at American University in Washington. And I was still in the Naval Reserve in our unit. I could drill with a unit in Washington. So through that Naval Reserve connection, I met many people working all over the place in Washington. And make a long story short, eventually ended up when my school was over, my graduate program at American University, I went to work for the International Division of what was then called the Bureau of the Budget, now it's OMB. And that's where I got started. I had taken enough economics that I could qualify as an economist and go there.
But you had never had any real drawing toward public service until you got through the service and you got into the master's program, huh?
Exactly. And I found that in terms of, I mean, I'd been thinking about international business, but then I found there were many other career tracks that where you needed these business skills, like, you know, financial analysis and et cetera, that were not actually traditional businesses, like the Export-Import Bank and USAID and the World Bank and so on. So I settled on trying to get into one of those sorts of things that, you know, had some, where business experience was valued, but it wasn't a traditional business.
And what years were you with the Bureau of the Budget?
So I was with the Bureau of the Budget from 64 to 67 in the International Division. And I was, there were eight of us that oversaw the whole, or, you know, with the budget examiners for the whole USAID budget, Food for Peace, military assistance, that whole segment of U.S. activities. The Budget Bureau, the OMB now, is part of the Executive Office of the President, which is basically the civil service career professional staff for the presidency. So they assist the president and the White House putting together the budget and so that it reflects the priority of the administration in carrying out their program. It serves, the professional staff serves, you know, Republicans, Democrats, et cetera. They don't change typically through administrations.
So the Bureau of the Budget was the first time that you really came into contact also with agricultural policy and Food for Peace that served you well later, I guess, huh?
Yes, exactly. That's right. And I got very interested in the changes that were taking place in agriculture overseas because that was one of the focal points of what USAID was trying to encourage. So I came to have to know something about that. And the more I learned about it, the more interested I got. And I was also taking courses at night at the Washington universities, American University, and sometimes at George Washington. But also the civil service generally, not just the Budget Bureau, had, probably still does have, a so-called mid-career educational program where you selected individuals are sent to a university for a year's graduate study, and typically in economics, but it could be in anything. And in my case, I felt that my economics was much at a much weaker foundation than most of my colleagues. So I was agitating to be able to go study that more intensively. And that's how I got the opportunity to go to Harvard under that program. In the meantime, just before that, I'd met Suzanne in Washington and we'd gotten married there. So she was just looking to transition from being a bilingual French-English secretary to being a preschool education teacher and with a master's degree. So we both went back to school there. She went to BU education program, and I went to the Harvard mid-career fellows program.
Now, what did was that a degree program?
It was, in a sense, it was. If you took your eight credits for a semester for two semesters, you got a master's in public administration. But when I went there, most of my colleagues in the Budget Bureau had PhDs in economics, and And I had been working toward a PhD nights in Washington. And I told both the Budget Bureau and Harvard when I went there that I was really interested in getting a PhD in economics. And the Budget Bureau said, if you can persuade Harvard to let you into that program, we'll just put you on leave until you finish that, and then you come back and work for the government as a PhD. That's a better investment for us than if you come back with a master's degree. So we'll, you know, we'll just put you, we won't give you, we won't extend your paid program for any more than a year, but we'll, you know, we'll give you a leave so you could do that. And so when I talked to the people at Harvard, I said, how would I, the programs I explored in American University particularly, they said, well, you're missing like 30 credits, undergraduate credits, so you'll have to get those first before we'll even consider you. But I talked to Harvard, and they said, well, for the next, for the year you're here, you take the courses that our PhD students would take, and we'll see how you do, and if you do okay, we'll let you into the program. So that was what made all the difference, because I was then newly married, and we wanted to have a child soon. So I couldn't, you know, deal with 30 more credits before I could even be talk about this program. But to make a long story short, I did satisfy their requirements, got into the program, and 3 years later left Harvard with a PhD and a new job with USAID in Turkey.
Wow.
Where we then ended up living for 3 years with USAID, and at the end of that time was recruited by the Rockefeller Foundation to stay there for 4 more years as an economist in their program, because I'd actually been doing some work with their program on sort of as part of what I was doing for USAID. They, the two organizations, had some joint programs in agriculture. So,
and when I first met you, you were back with the Rockefeller Foundation in the United States. How did you get back
exactly
here?
Exactly. And then what happened then is that our program in Turkey came to an end. We were actually there for 4 years with the Rockefeller Foundation. I came back to New York, and the program ended in Turkey. The Rockefeller Foundation program ended. So I came back to New York and worked on a variety of programs, but all involving food and agriculture, which was at that time a major feature of the Rockefeller Foundation's programming. And we had a program in Tunisia that I thought was a natural for the Apple II and VisiCalc, which I had learned about through the good auspices of your organization in New York, the Big Apple Users Group. And the rest of this story you know, but we had this program where we were, I had talked about what I thought they could do with VisiCalc, because they were doing all this laborious pencil and paper spreadsheet work. And then if somebody asked them to look at some other, you know, to change something, then obviously they had to start all over again with their pencil and paper things. And I said it would be so much better if you just had this Apple II and VisiCalc. You could do all this and much more. And they were very enthusiastic, so I had some control over the budget, so I just put those in the budget. But then the issue was, how would they be trained? And I don't know at what point you want to get into that story, but that's where this whole power sharing story begins.
That's where it begins. Well, the original thing was that we were going to go over, Barbara McMullen, who I worked for, and I still do, I was going to go over to Tunisia, and that, then that didn't work out, and it was you that came up with the idea of doing the video series. So why don't you take it from there?
Yeah, well, because I'd seen you and Barbara in your trainings, I thought, well, the ideal thing, I was afraid that these computers would arrive. I only went to Tunisia intermittently, that these computers would arrive in Tunisia, and my Tunisian colleagues would take them out of the box and be flummoxed as to how to proceed from, you know, where they were with the machines in the boxes to where I'd sort of sketched out for them that I thought they could be with VisiCalc and so on. So I thought, well, the perfect thing would be to have John and Barbara go there and give a week-long workshop. Then with that, we could really get the bosses as well as the people who were going to be actually manipulating the data involved. Because I thought if the bosses didn't fully understand the potential, it was not likely to work. They were not likely to give it the support that it would take to really integrate it in their work system. And I had gotten the bosses' commitment if we would give them the machines, send them the machines, and trainers, they would show up at the workshops. And you and Barbara graciously agreed to go. But then my boss, and I may have not been quite as blunt at the time as was really the story behind the story, so to speak. My boss really was very hostile to Apple computers. I had proselytized about them in the office. And he said, these are not serious machines. These are people play games on these and so on. This is not something the Rockefeller Foundation is going to support. And he said, I'm not going to try to take them out of the budget because you've got these people all excited that they're coming, but there is no way I'm going to fund two, a husband and wife team, to go to the beach in Tunisia to give a workshop. The hotel probably would have been on the beach, by the way. I mean, that's just because most of the city is on the Mediterranean. So, you know, that's where the main hotels are where you would host something like this. And I was very angry and felt totally stonewalled. And I'd been, during the time I'd been in Turkey, I had had some experience with a video camera and had actually shot with a fellow who was very adept at it, had done some video shooting in the field. And then when I came back to New York, I enrolled in a program at Downtown Community TV. You probably know that program. And had learned something about video production and had somehow met a woman named Martha Stewart, the video producer, not the Martha Stewart that is more well-known nowadays. The Martha Stewart, the video producer, is long since deceased. But so I'd been working with Martha on some video ideas with the foundation, nothing to do with computers. And when John, my boss, shut down the door on our workshop, I called Martha and I said, Martha, if I could get John and Barbara to agree to do a videotape of the training they would provide if they'd gone there, or at least a version of it, would you be willing to videotape it, and what would it cost? She said, Charles, I think that's such a chip, probably. Chip, I think that's such a great idea. I would put up the time and everything if you'll just underwrite the renting the equipment. So that's what we did, and we together produced this. First, it started out, I think, as about 3.5 hours of workshop, which was in quite detail and was very suitable for the Tunisian purpose. But then later, we reduced that to a 45-minute, approximately 45-minute, maybe something like that anyway, about 45-minute introduction to the microcomputer, not so much on VisiCalc in that one. And Martha and you and Barbara and I took that to Comdex and tried to sell that. And eventually it sold a fair number of copies, but I must say it didn't come close to covering the costs. But because it turns out that, as I've subsequently learned in much more depth, shooting, if you're trying to produce a video product, shooting it is not the most expensive part of the operation. So, anyway, I don't mean to just keep rambling on here. So you guide this as to where you think it should go, because you're part of the story after that.
And the original video is now available to us at https://vimeo.com/338051301. That's https://vimeo.com/338051301. You'll be amazed at how different I look than how the same Barbara looks. I will, once again, if there's anyone interested in these links, just send me email to johnmack13@gmail.com. And I'll get them off to you. How did the actual work go in Tunisia then, when you got them over there?
Well, I'm not entirely sure. They did get them out of the boxes. They did have the videos. They did watch the videos. I'm not sure quite what the learning process was, but they did learn how to use VisiCalc. And they did, and the writing program, you'd have to remind me even what it was now, but the word processing program. And it was transformational. It was, in fact, I've written an article about it. I should probably post the link on our website, but I'll do that. Because it really was transformational in the agricultural product. They could now go through and say, well, suppose we had more fertilizer, what would the production implications of that be? And they could run that very quickly. And the bosses could say to the technical staff, you know, they could pose what-if questions and actually get answers back in a very short amount of time. And a more unforeseen development, they could, they produced reports to go up the line to the senior policymakers that were much more informative, much more timely, and were very effective in getting a clearer understanding of the situation in the field, and therefore more clear, more effective responses when things would go off track. So it was really a big success in short.
And for the audience who may not be familiar with this, because we're going back a number of years, VisiCalc was the first spreadsheet on a computer. There had never been a spreadsheet that people could use on mainframes or on minis. It eventually gave way to 123 from the Lotus Development Corporation and finally to Microsoft Excel. But this was revolutionary at that time, and it was owed all to two people that became friends of the both of us, of Dan Brooklyn and Bob Frankston, who also came out of Harvard. And after the videotapes were produced, and you mentioned that you, Barbara, and I took the of the show on the road of the Comdex in Atlantic City, and also to a show in Boston where we did further recording, but also the videotapes were made available to libraries, and so they had an educational impact that we don't even know about through libraries. Tell us about your trip to Boston and you're filming there.
Well, John, as you what this led, I observed when you were doing the interviews that Martha had us do before you actually got to the instruction, how many times you and Barbara mentioned the word power and the word sharing. You can see it in the film. And so we came up with just linking those two words together, and we called it the Power Sharing Series. And then maybe within a year later, you can tell me what the dates were, but around that time anyway, you and others of your colleagues in New York organized a computer fair at the UN International School, and you brought in a dazzling array of 30 real pioneers in the computer world, from Seymour Papert and his work on Logo at MIT to Wozniak and the Apple II, and et cetera. And I asked you if you had any thoughts of recording this, because this is such an extraordinary gathering of people. And my recollection of what you said was that we'll be doing well to get this all just to come off, never mind record it. But if you can organize recording it, then please do. And maybe you can sell the tapes to people and they can, you know, recover your cost. Well, I did. I went to Martha and contracted with her sound man, Bob Kyle. You may remember him. He worked on our shoot at your house. To record all of those presentations, and obviously we couldn't have a recording audio engineer in each place, but we had a recorder of some sort in each one, and with varying degrees of success, we got recordings from virtually all of those sessions, and some of them were really very good. Some were They had technical problems because people didn't position the mic right or whatever. But in any event, I had those. There was very little demand for the tapes at the time, but my interest was in just capturing those moments when these developments were relatively fresh. That was sort of went back to my time as a historian, as a history major. And I just thought, this is an extraordinary time that all this stuff is taking place, and it would really be wonderful to have these people recorded. So I had those tapes with me for some time, and then several years later, the program at the Rockefeller Foundation that I was working in was brought to an end, and I was basically unnecessary there anymore. And as a parting, I had a year's sabbatical coming to me from the time that I'd been with them in the field. That was part of the deal of their field staff. For every 4 years you were in the field, you got a year at a university. So I went to Harvard, which had this International Development Advisory Program, to work on a book that another fellow and I had been writing. On this sabbatical, and when I got to Boston, I realized that between the Boston Computer Society and the Computer Museum, there were extraordinary talks going on there, and I thought, well, I should continue this power-sharing series and record these. So I talked to Jonathan Rutenberg, the president of the BCS, and Gwen Bell, the director of the museum. They were both enthusiastic, as long as they didn't have to pay anything for it. I had a little money because my father had passed away and I'd gotten some small inheritance from him. So I was in a position to do that because it was clear to me by then that this was not going to pay. You know, it wasn't a bankable commercial proposition. But it seemed to me really too bad that if have these fantastic talks with these computer pioneers and have nobody recording it. So I did that from when I went to Harvard in 1984 until I left on an overseas assignment with Harvard in 1991. I tried to stop at one point because it was really had become extremely expensive and time-consuming. And Gwen Bell persuaded me, you know, Charles, if you don't do this, nobody's going to do it. It's really important for posterity that you record these things. So I kept at it. And then they all went into storage when I went overseas, and they stayed there until we moved down here to Falmouth. And they followed me, or I had to truck all these things around with me every time we moved somewhere. All these, I mean, didn't take them overseas, obviously, but they were in storage in various places until I decided, I'm now 85, I decided if I don't get these digitized and in some kind of proper form for posterity, they're all going to cease to be of any interest in their current form. I mean, who's going to listen to audio tapes?
Go ahead.
No, so that I had the good fortune to get a hold of Gordon Bell, who is a trustee at the Computer History Museum. And I was looking to find him because to try to reach Gwen, who it turned out was quite sick at the time. And he was very supportive and put me in touch with a gentleman named Gardner Hendry, who was a trustee, is a trustee at the Computer History Museum, and has a keen interest in oral histories. And trying to keep the story short, Gardner called me up after that and said, I'd like to come down and see what these tapes look like that you have. So down he came, and here are these boxes and boxes of big open reel, beautiful Ampex tapes, and many more boxes of high quality, mastering cassette tapes, etc. And so the Computer History Museum has been quite helpful. The main thing that Gardner did is he said, look, he said it's going to take you forever to try to digitize all these things. Suppose the museum just takes on digitizing them and you take on the task of remastering the ones, you know, that you've already produced on audio tape, 92 of them. And there was another 40 or so that I'd recorded and never had time to do anything with the source tapes. So to make a long story short, that over 5 years, it was an endless process, I managed to get all those out with help from a young man named Tom Fricker, who was a computer science person who was just entering Tufts when we started. He's just graduated last year. So he helped me with that as a volunteer. And so now it's 134 tapes all available on this flash drive at Amazon. They're all remastered in digital form and reintroduced with the date of the event and so on, but with the original introductions that I narrated at the time at the wherever the venue was. So
I had Gwen speak to the IBM PC group and to the Apple II group, and she was terrific. And she also spoke about the this was while you were overseas, and she also spoke about the power sharing and to what that she knew about.
Yeah, she was a great supporter. Although it's interesting, she put these up for sale in the computer museum in Boston, in the store, and it's amazing how few were sold. So I mean, I've never had any illusions that this is going to be a big, you know, commercial venture. My hope is that we can get these through people like you who are interested and are in a position where they're spreaders of word to an potentially interested audience, that we can get enough interest of these to go, that they get lodged in libraries and universities and schools that have significant computer programs, so that, you know, they're available. And now in this format on the flash drive, there the whole series is available in one place, whereas when you were trying to do this as audio cassettes, it was just a really daunting task. It took notebooks and notebooks full of audio tapes to get, you know.
Sure, it's terrific.
Give somebody
a
copy of it.
I planned to send some of the to play some of it, but we do have a lot to do. We probably won't do that. However, I do have the person on the line from Massachusetts that may have been on to one of the tapes. Is that you, Dan?
Yeah, I'm here.
Is that Dan Brickman?
Yes, it is.
Wonderful. Oh, one of the stars of all time.
I'm looking at the list of everything that you have on those recordings. I've listened to some. You look at the list of who you have, and it's unbelievable on that flash drive. I mean, you have Gates and Jobs and Wozniak. You have Timothy. Timothy Leary. You have Marvin Minsky, Kurzweil, Dyson, that was Philip Kahn. You know, these are all these people from the early days of computers. Bill Atkinson talking about HyperCard, introducing it, the introduction of the next machine when Steve Jobs introduced it at Symphony Hall in Boston, which was an incredible event. I remember it there, and it sounds just like it, you know, having, you know, listened to that, that recording that you have. So, I mean, from a historical viewpoint, anybody who remembers those old days or cares to learn about it, you have all the people. The guy who did Space War, which was like the first video game, the granddaddy of all, before all of them, from way back when, you have Steve Russell. And that, it's just the hundred and some, it's pretty incredible. And it really is something that, you know, needs to be saved for the history of this industry, because this is those people, this is their words. You get to hear what they're like, what they, what they were thinking of, what their dreams were about the future as they talk about it. It's pretty amazing. And their recordings are pretty high quality.
And once again, for the audience, there would not have been any of this. There would not have been, the at this point anyhow, the proliferation of computers into offices and then eventually into homes, if it weren't for VisiCalc and for Dan Bricklin and for the Bob Frankson, who I both regard as personal friends.
Yeah,
and one
he,
of
wrote,
the,
he wrote most of the code. Yeah.
And one of the interesting things that you can say about Dan is that for all his contributions and his skill, he's even a better person. Chip, to you.
Well,
I did care about.
I should note that Dan was behind the earlier recordings of the Boston Computer Society meetings on videotape, actually, before I got involved at all. I wasn't even in Boston at that time.
And we at my company, Software Arts, we basically paid to have somebody videotape, to have Glenn Koenig to do videotapes of the meetings, you know, including when Jobs announced, you know, showed the Macintosh. It had been up like a few days after it had been announced publicly, but this is the first time at a computer user group, a big one that everybody could go to, where he had the whole development team flew in, and we have that on videotape, and we had all these other videotapes of the early computer people that came to the Boston Computer Society, thanks to Jonathan Rotenberg's great abilities to be able to track those people. And those tapes were then also given to the Computer History Museum. And with the generous donation of people like Brad Feld and others, we've been able to get those tapes restored, and they're available on the Computer History Museum website. And I think you even have, you have the audio of one of them, except I guess you have better audio, the one of that incredible the meeting that Jonathan Rotenberg put together, where they have the heads of all the major computer companies, personal computer companies.
Yes. Actually, the way that came about, Dan, was I was recording the game symposium at the Computer Museum. And, oh, my goodness, you'll have to help me with his name. It's gone out of my head right now. But the guy behind Creative Computing came to that meeting.
Yeah, David Hall.
Yes, David Hall, exactly.
But you also have
came over to me, and he said, look, you're doing a great service with these recordings. He said, we have an audio recording of that Pioneers thing. Would you like to put that in your series? And I said, that would be fabulous. So he loaned me the tape. It was a cassette
tape.
It wasn't super high quality. But
now, is that the one? Because we have a videotape, which is available on the Computer History Museum website.
Exactly. And I gave to them my audio recording. I don't know if they ever spliced that, you know, used that as
a
soundtrack or not.
It's very tough. Very tough to listen to, but it's unbelievable. It has the head of at the time it was a Commodore, Jim Finke. It was Bill Gates talking about his dreams of what was going to happen with the personal computer. This is 1981, October of 1981. It was a major person at Atari, John Shirley of Radio Shack, who then later went on to join Microsoft. Mike Markula, the CEO of Apple. Don Estridge, who was the creator of the IBM PC, who was the head of that group, and it was the first time any of us had ever seen him on stage, and it was like a coup to have him there. And then the executive VP, Nigel Searle of Sinclair. So these were all these, you know, they were all in one panel. Nobody got a panel of people like that together. You know, Ben Rosen was there. Like, where do we get all these people? And he ran a major conference. And Jonathan Rotenberg, who was this high school kid who was running the Boston Computer Society, was able to pull this off. You know, it's around the time he went off to Brown University and then later to Harvard Business School. But that, historic-wise, to hear the view of what personal computers were or would be from the industry people was incredible. And that's one of your, what, program 166 or 167.
Yeah, exactly. And that was very exciting. That when David gave that to me, I produced that, you know, shortly after I got it, and it did have a lot of problems. But
yeah,
it's listenable. I think we have an apology
came
in there.
From our video camera. It may have been a video camera.
Well, it might have. That's possible. But he said
which was
they
in the
done
audience.
Their own recording.
Yeah.
That may
interject
with a bit of a personal history, too. When I was leaving Morgan Stanley, when Barbara and I were going to form our own business, we got to meet the aforementioned Ben Rosen. And Ben showed us an Apple II. On its desk, and we were mainframe financial people, and the Apple II played a game. It was connected to a by an acoustic coupler to a weather service, the Farmers Weather Service in Tennessee or in Kentucky, and there was a program of the Dow Jones Market Analyzer running a cassette. And I said, gee, I have to get one of those just to fool around with, because at that time that was what people did. About 3 months later, after I had it, Ben got a copy of the beta copy of VisiCalc and talked to me about it and shared it with me. We changed our whole business to train people using a spreadsheet. And then we were active. I had been an English major in college, but I didn't do anything but technology. But then someone from Popular Computing Magazine contacted Dan, and they wanted him to write an article about how people use this. And he said, well, he really didn't do that. But they should speak to Barbara McMullen, who knew more about how users did it than anyone that he knew of. They contacted them, and we got into writing because of that. And after we stopped doing heavy tech, and I wound up, of all things, becoming the poet and the poet laureate of my town, it's all because we were in Rosen's office. We were introduced to VisiCalc. We got to know Dan and Bob through the product and through the show that we did at NYU that Bob came down, and then the show that we did at the UN, and then to the Rosen conferences, and then getting him to writing. So we're at an example of people that VisiCalc changed our lives. Thank you, Dan.
Well, Ben was pretty amazing. I mean, it's pretty amazing. He's one of the tapes also. You know, Ben ended up, you know, being the funder of Compaq and Lotus Development Corporation. And, you know, he's the venture capitalist who helped get those places started. And, you know, pretty heavy. I mean, before that, you know, when he was at Morgan Stanley, he ran the major conference in the industry that later then became Esther Dyson's conference. Which was the place where all of us got together at least every year. and to talk to each other and to talk about the industry. I remember at that in the recording of that particular BCS meeting, the one in 1981, where they had all the people on stage, it has a recording of Finke's famous talk about how, you know, here we are, the PC industry. We think we're so hot. Well, right now, you know, we're about the size of the pantyhose industry, is what he said. And next year, if we're lucky, we'll become as big as the potato chip industry. And, you know, we thought we were – and now that's how big we were in those days. And, you know, we had big thoughts for it. And, you know, next thing we know, the guy sitting up there on stage becomes the richest guy in the world and one of the most – now one of the most important philanthropists in the world, you know, thanks to the personal computer. And, you know, Apple becomes – you know, one of the top companies and influential in changing all sorts of stuff. And, you know, that also they had their head was up there too. And but we were, in the old days, we were these young guys. I remember at one of Ben's conferences, we were standing around there and we thought we were pretty hot. And then Muhammad Ali walked by because he was at that, he was at that hotel. And we're all just sitting there with our jaws hanging out because he was the greatest, you know. And we're talking about people on the order of Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, who later on became, you know, or like gods in the industry. But
That was Esther's conference in Palm Springs.
Ben was at Lotus was then. That was just starting with Lotus. It was just becoming a venture capitalist.
And somebody, what's his name, heavyweight fighter, was working out there, and people came
That's
to
right.
see him training. And all of a sudden, Ali showed up to watch him training, and there were more people to watch Ali than anything.
Oh, yeah. I mean, did you see Ali when he walked by? I mean, I remember
yeah,
we
yes.
were walking for one thing. Yep. And was Jobs there at that?
Oh. Yeah, they flew in, Jobs and Markler and Scully. Then
we're all there at that point, and we're all like, you know, because as I recall, it was like near them, and we were all sitting there slack-jawed because we thought, well, I guess we're seeing Muhammad Ali. And but then, you know, in today's world, of course, you know, a few years ago, if you saw Steve Jobs, it was like, my God, there's Steve Jobs, you know. So the world is an interesting world. And from those early days, it's really interesting to listen to people's views of where things would go and to see where they really did. And that these were the people whose dreams made it happen.
Yeah, and it changed the lives of so many people and the way businesses operated. And then, of course, when telecommunications took over the world, and we had the web browser bring it into every home, and it changed the way that we shop, the way that we talk, and you know, and it's
all these things change
in a very short time.
John, you're one of the early users, you know, of VisiCalc and teachers of it now, and now they're like what on the order of a billion users of spreadsheets.
Yeah,
you know?
And I mean, in the beginning, Barbara and I made a lot of money training people using NAT and word processing, and it took us to California and to Mexico and to Puerto Rico, and now grammar
right.
school kids,
right.
they just use
it.
Yeah.
Well, you're both on there and on the subject of spreadsheets. John, you were asking about my earlier experiences as a development economist. My latter part of my 4-year residence in Malawi in Africa, working on some very serious food problems, with using a spreadsheet and the ability to work through different assumptions of how much fertilizer might and seed might be available, I was able to actually predict the mathematical certainty of a near famine if more seed and fertilizer were not brought into the country before planting time. And that was able to persuade the World Bank there was a lot of ideology about handing out free food and free fertilizer and so on. But that the spreadsheet persuaded the World Bank, I mean the ironclad rule of the arithmetic persuaded the World Bank that there was really no alternative but to hand to put more, and it had to be free because people didn't have the money to buy it, to put more fertilizer and seed into the system before planting time, or else they would have to bring in huge amounts of food aid after the fact to address the shortfall. And the spreadsheet just, you could tell that there was, you know, it was the arithmetic. And if that was persuasive, and it happened, and there was not a famine.
And you
people
all
don't remember.
Phone.
People don't remember what it was like before when you had to do it by hand, and some of those calculations were for small groups were just prohibitive to be able to do the calculations. I mean, the government could do
exactly.
Things like calculations for for building bombs and stuff, but. You know, and big corporations maybe could have armies of people doing it, but individuals and some, you know, an NGO out in the field, it wasn't possible without the power of these personal computers. So that's
and this was also made it transparent enough that other people could work through and try their own assumptions and so on and see what the result would be, and so it was persuasive in a way that no strings of words could be.
Yeah, I mean it's pretty cool how we're all part of this, spreading the use and being able to use personal computers to be able to leverage people, and we take it for granted today, but it's the power that we were able to bring for so many different areas, and of course that then fed on itself by being able to have less expensive machines and less expensive or more powerful machines, et cetera, to be able to bring them to more and more people. I mean, what Bill's goal was to put a computer on every desk, and which he succeeded at, and which is pretty cool. His stated goal was not to be the richest guy in the world, though he became that. But it was to do that, to put it, and to hear about how they did that, and how each of the different attempts to do different types of work. We have some of the videos at the Computer History Museum were of some early robots and stuff like that. And now it's I think you have stuff with Leah Lanier. I think about early VR work and stuff like that, and Metcalf talking about work groups. The guy who invented Ethernet, talking in '87. So the old days were kind of cool, and I just hope that it's preserved, And I am so happy that you were able to get these out. I mean, it sounds like an infomercial, but I'm only saying this because I care about it, and I think from a history viewpoint, we want to have this stuff. You don't want to look back and then say, well, how did it ever start?
No, that's exactly right, Dan, and that's why I've pursued and persevered in this, because I care about it. I would be embarrassed to tell you the financial aspects of this, frankly.
It's
so far from a commercially viable operation. It's ridiculous.
No, the fact that we have a lot of this, this stuff available, at least, and hopefully the museum keeps it, and other places people will pick up your recordings and stuff, is because of a lot of people who donated their time and money to do it, who believe in that, because we think that understanding the origins is important, especially for people in technology and all, to understand stuff of how they're part of an ongoing history, how the people who got the stuff started are like them in many ways, but to learn from the past about what works and what doesn't, and what maybe should be tried again that didn't work, that maybe now's the time for, and you know, to understand those people. It's just like we study history of other stuff, we should study the history of technology.
Another important thing, and we're only talking about the 40-year period, is that those of us that were in, that were involved believed in what we were doing. So it wasn't just a commercial thing. That was what brought the Boston Computer Society together, the Big Apple User Group, NYPC, the fair that he mentioned, the United Nations Fair. It was an exciting time, and you really thought you were impacting business and government and everything at the time. And I don't know if we're not, if we don't need something like that now in diffractive society, that we don't need some other cause, some other changing thing. I don't want to go on like a religious experience, but I think that's very important.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we read all the stuff about the Revolutionary War and about, you know, and other times when there were big changes that occurred. Each of those big changes, you know, throughout history, there were certain periods when a lot of stuff happened. And it's helpful to understand the people, understand what was behind it and why it ended up the way it is. And maybe if we're not happy how it ended up, be able to understand how in the future to be able to make things end up better. Or if it ended up good and we want to follow along that way, the same things. That's what history is for.
There's a cheat sheet available for the audience at www.thepowersharingseries.com. That's all one word, thepowersharingseries.com. And the flash drive is available from Amazon at $59.95. It's a tremendous, tremendous deal, and I hope you.
Well, 64.
Sell about 9 million.
64 gigabytes. You're not making money on 64 gigabytes of material. It includes video and stuff. So it's
right. And it's a 3.0, Dan. Just for those who know what that means, it's not a 2.0. It's a USB 3.
Yeah. Well, I found with mine, I basically had to copy the files onto my laptop to be able to play them well. But they played very nicely, and
it's basically a delivery mechanism and an archiving mechanism, as far as my idea.
Well, it's amazing we can do that. As you say, you used to have to carry around boxes and boxes and boxes of stuff.
Exactly.
And now you get this one little box the size of a deck of cards that you open up, and inside of it is a little flash drive. And this envelope comes from Amazon with the thing on it, and I really thank you so much for going to all the trouble and money to be able to get this material and to have it available in the museums, and it's very heartening about that, especially as more and more of the people are no longer with us. You know, I look at the list of some of the people there, and there are people who aren't with us anymore. And here's some of their legacy, and it's important to today. If you want to know where things came from and how they developed matter.
Well, thank you very much. It's so meaningful coming from both of you to have those thoughts. That's serious psychic income to the project.
Yeah, well, hopefully people are by. I saw a lot of people retweeted my tweet about it a couple weeks ago, and I hope some of them bought it.
Well, I'm going to go on faith and order some more, so.
Yeah.
Dan, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you, John. It was a pleasure to be on your show.
You know, one of the good things about the show not going 3 weeks ago, Chip, was that Dan couldn't be on because of the Glorious Holiday that night. But when we got back on the air, he was available to us.
Well, isn't that nice?
Yeah, good. Sometimes things work out. There are a lot of coincidences that happen. And you know, so that's good.
Well, thanks again. And
well,
Chip,
very nice to spend this evening with both of you.
Thank you.
Here.
Thank you very much, Chip. And you know, once again, to the audience, it's available on Amazon for $59.95. It was a tremendous purchase. I'm extremely happy with them. And I'm slowly going through the hours and hours. And as I mentioned, I look very different now, but the beautiful Barbara does not. So thanks again.
Yeah,
for this.
I know. I had black hair back then, yeah.
It's been a real pleasure. Send any compliments to me about the show or for any URLs to johnmack13@gmail.com. And be sure to join me again next week at the same 7 p.m. Eastern for my conversation with Michael Grace. Go to my website, www.johnmack13, for the URLs of upcoming shows and of previous shows. And as I mentioned earlier, for commercial things, my books are available on Amazon, as is the flash drive that we're talking about. Thanks again, everybody, and good night, and we'll go off with the Eagles again. Amazon, play Taking It Easy.
What do you want me to play?
Take It Easy by the Eagles.
Here's Take It Easy from your library on Amazon Music.
Down the road, you know, she's not. Thanks again, everybody, and good night. Don't you just want to know me?